VanWee Financial is a registered investment advisor. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with a qualified financial advisor and or tax professional before implementing any strategy discussed herein.
Welcome to the VanWee Financial Hour on AM 600 and FM 100.5. WBOB. To be part of the program, call 222-TALK. That's 222-8255. Now here are your hosts of the VanWee Financial Hour, Steve and Adam VanWee.
It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the VanWee Financial Hour. I'm Steve VanWee.
And I'm Adam VanWee.
And we are here on this yet another magnificent North Florida sunny, I guess you'd call it a real springy day. We're on a tear.
Yeah, it's beautiful out. Great Mother's Day weekend.
Absolutely. It couldn't be better. I unfortunately do no longer have a mother on with us, but my kids and grandkids have a whole bunch of them. So it should be a lot of fun. Anyway, I've lots to talk about today. In fact, I think my stack of junk is probably twice as big as it is on average.
Well, it's way bigger than twice as big because last week that's
right.
Nothing.
You had to compare anything to zero. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that we don't want your help. I know we asked for help last week. I said, since I was a little oversightful and forgot my stuff, but of course Adam always brings his anyway. So, but anyway, we will sit here for an hour, and I hope you do too. And we will talk about whatever we want to talk about. Unless you pick up the phone and dial 904-222-8255, at which time we will immediately talk about what you want to talk about. Now, there have to be issues on people's mind regarding money because, well, there always are. And we just got through tax season. And as Angela Walker was pointing out, hurricane season is coming up. There's so many topics that are germane today. But overriding all of that, we have things like the debt ceiling nonsense and inflation. Yeah, we can talk a lot about that. It's definitely following the pattern we've been laying out for quite some time. It's sticky and stubborn and all that, but there's reason to believe that it's going to turn out better pretty soon.
It's actually coming down faster than it went up, which is
weird.
Doesn't feel that way, but
no, it doesn't.
It has reached the level from the peak. It's reached the level that it's at today faster than it was from the level it's at today to the peak. So
the problem with that analysis, and everybody in the press misses it, is that even though inflation is coming down quickly, it's called the rate of inflation that's coming down quickly. Every month, the price level, the overall price level, is higher than it was a month before. And when that starts to change, that's called deflation.
Well, you don't want that.
That's not good.
That's not good.
Right. Yeah. We have disinflation going on now, and that is a very good thing. We'll have to get used to the new
prices,
price level.
Yeah.
But you know, we've been through periods like that before. Yeah, it takes a little time to shake it out and all that. We'll get more into that later, too. But the news is fundamentally pretty good on that front, I think.
Yeah.
And we showed
it
this week.
Definitely.
And I'll let Adam explain all that because that leads us right into the market.
It was a really odd week in the market. It felt terrible. But how can it be a terrible week if the NASDAQ officially exits a bear market and goes back into a bull market?
Yeah, and closes the week up.
Yeah. So the NASDAQ was up 0.4%, and like I mentioned, it's up 20% off its lows now, which is typically a very bullish sign. But the other two indexes were down. The S&P dropped 0.3%, so basically flat. But the Dow was down 1.1%, and the Dow's been really, really struggling this year.
Yeah, I haven't looked. There's only 30 components in the Dow, and I have not looked to see which one it is that's holding us down. I don't know if you have.
On Friday, was it Disney and one other one were dragging it? Salesforce, maybe?
Oh, yeah, Disney lost about 8%.
Yeah.
You see the problem very clearly, and this is why we've been saying for years, following the Dow might be a lot of fun because the numbers are so big. But it's certainly not a very good representation of the broad market.
Oh, it's a horrible representation. The S&P is 10 times better index for knowing what's actually going on.
More than 10 times if you just count it.
I'm not talking by the number of companies, but it's just a better overall indicator of what's happening. Tracking 30 price-weighted stocks, it doesn't make any sense. We've said it many times. So don't look at the Dow. Look at the S&P. And the S&P is having a nice year. It's up, 7.4%?
7.4%.
Yeah. And the Dow is basically flat. The Nasdaq's on a tear, though. It really had an excellent run. But it was the first index to roll over. Mm-hmm. It rolled over in October of 21. Yeah, 21. And it had the worst year last year. It was down 30-something percent. Mm-hmm. So it had the furthest to rebound, and it's already happened. But it makes you wonder, is that a leading indicator for the market, the rest of the market, or is it just an anomaly? I don't know.
I don't know either. We've got to December 31. We just got a mirror out, and from then on, it's been whatever was up is down, whatever was down is up.
For sure.
And through all of that, we've gone nowhere.
Yep. And one of the biggest areas that's really an indicator of what was hot is not hot anymore, value stocks. They sold off again. Mid-cap value was down over 2%, and small-cap value down over 2.5% this week alone.
Good news is those that are dividend payers, which is most of the value stocks, the yields are
looking
pretty nice.
Yeah, well, they have to be to compete with higher interest rates.
Yep.
On a sector basis, materials and energy both fell over 2%. And all but one sector of the S&P was down. Communication services was the only sector to post gains.
And you might be somewhat quizzical about that because that one has sucked for so long.
Well, actually, recently it's been fairly good.
Fabulous, yeah.
But it's also a kind of a, if you're looking for to lower your correlation to the overall market, buy communication services because it tends to go down when the market goes up and vice versa. International stocks were even weaker than the U.S., which is something we haven't seen much of lately. Hong Kong and China were both down over 3%, while Australia, Germany, Italy, and the U.K. were all down over 2%. Brazil went the other direction, up over 3%. Why not? They just elected a socialist criminal. And Mexico was up over 1%. Emerging markets didn't fare very well, lost over 2%, while developed nations did a bit better. They were down just over 1%. Commodities also fell, losing over 2%. They were dragged down by the price of silver, ironically. I don't know what drove that, but it was down 6%.
As of a week ago, it had been up 28.8% since the Silicon Valley Bank went belly up.
Yep.
That's not very many days.
No, definitely not.
It probably just got a little overzealous. I don't know if we have to overthink it.
It was definitely a week of reversals because natural gas gained over 7%. It was down 55% last quarter. So it just looked like people were putting money into sectors that were beaten up over the year to date. Bonds also lost a bit of value during the week. The aggregate bond ETF lost 21 basis points. So more or less flat, but all negative signs across the entire bond series. So interesting week. There wasn't a lot of positive about it, but it wasn't. At the same time, it just wasn't terrible, and you saw the NASDAQ enter a bull market. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. If you can figure this out, give me a call.
Please let me know. Yeah. The two things that caught my eye this week, one of them I don't like. Actually, neither of them do I like, but one is more meaningful than the other. The semiconductors, who've been on a tear, and they're widely considered leading indicators for the market, they broke down a bit this week.
Not really, though. Like, I saw that analysis, and I kind of disagree. It's not nearly as bad as what the overall tone of that report was. They're just in a sideways trading range, and they could go either way.
Okay. Well, that was one, and the other one was we've been touting the first-time unemployment claims, and as soon as we take this break and come back, we'll talk about what happened. Don't go anywhere. This is the VanWee Financial Hour. Right. Welcome back to the VanWee Financial Hour. I'm Steve VanWee.
And I'm Adam VanWee.
And we've been doing the market wrap. We're not quite wrapped up with that yet, but I did want to bring up the trivia question today. Brought to you, as usual, by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. You can call Ken at 904-636-7888. Been spending a lot of time on what I think is probably the number one economic issue in the country right now, and that being inflation. And Adam and I have been saying that it's been a little bit underreported with some of the things that happened. One of the major components here, the Bureau of Labor Statistics in the government keeps track of inflation at two levels, wholesale and retail. The retail is called the Consumer Price Index, and the wholesale is called the Producer Price Index. The Producer Price Index is falling more abruptly, but that's not the question. The question is, how many months in a row has the Producer Price Index risen faster than the Consumer Price Index? In other words, consumers, the retailers, have not been able to keep up with those massive increases for quite some time. How many months in a row? And then we'll go over the implications of why that seems to be rolling over and what it portends for especially the next Fed meeting. So we'll see. If you can get that one, we'll trigger it. Otherwise, I'll give it to you at the end. But please try. It's a pretty easy number.
Yep. I thought the biggest number of the week was not that one, although that was a big one. The biggest number was 268,000.
Yep.
No, 264,000. Sorry, yeah. 264,000. And why is that a big number? Because one of the best indicators of a recession is the weekly initial jobless claims. And when you see that number tick over 250,000, it's almost 100% guaranteed that you are going to hit a recession. And guess what happened this week? 264 up from under 250 last week. Yep. It's been on a steady increase. It's now up 82,000 since last September. And typically when you see numbers over a rise in weekly jobless claims over about 50, 52,000, that is also an excellent indicator of a recession. So when you see 82,000, that's well into the danger zone.
Well in.
I between the yield curve and the jobless claims and any other indicator, leading indicator of recession you want to look at, I would venture to say we are either in one or we are going to see one this month, next month, sometime this summer. It's just almost inevitable at this point.
Yeah, the other 800-pound gorilla is—I almost said Janet Yellen, but that wouldn't sound good.
No, that's not appropriate.
It is what she's responsible for. The debt ceiling discussion that's going on right now is, of course, and as usual, widely talked about as something that. Put it this way. In order to make it lead, they wanted it to bleed. Mm-hmm. So they've got America on its toes or heels in some cases because they really, really want headlines out of this thing. So Yellen came up with the June 1st, we're probably going to run out of money thing and da-da-da-da-da, and then Biden won't talk and this and that and the other thing. That is, at this point, at least, a tempest in a teapot. The government is not running out of money.
No.
And it will not run out of money on June 1st. And on June 15th, all the corporate returns and all the the 1099 people have their installment due on June 15th. That is going to be an influx of money, the likes of which they couldn't spend in a month if they really, really tried. So what's going to happen is they will borrow from Peter and PayPal and shift it around. Social Security lends to the Agriculture Department, which does this and does that. And it's a non-issue that's meant solely to scare the heck out of both sides because one side wants to spend and one side doesn't want to spend and one side wants to tax and on and on. It has always been thus. It will always be thus. And neither side. The Republicans will say it goes square on Biden if it happens. And yeah. Biden says it goes square on the Republicans who won't negotiate. And they both have elements of truth. And therefore, they're both scared. And therefore, they'll cut a deal. Mm-hmm. They always do. It could be midnight the night before. It could be a temporary something or other. But what we don't want to do, this one is just as funny as it could be to people like me, what we don't want to do is mint a trillion-dollar coin and then give it to the Fed and say, now you've got $1 trillion more money. What would be the source of that $1 trillion? A little piece of platinum or whatever they make it out of. But there, it's not, it wasn't created. It was minted. It's like printing money, only it's minting money. So the powers that be in the brilliant financial media, and that means Paul Krugman, for those of you who know who he is, who has never gotten anything right in his life and yet still has a Nobel Prize and a PhD in economics. But he said he's got a better idea now. He wants to print some specialty bonds and sell them. They will carry higher interest rates than others to make them attractive. And he says minting $1 trillion is inflationary, which he denied up until last week when he came up with his new idea. But printing $1 trillion is not inflationary, to which I say he's still 100% wrong. The guy just can't get it right.
The worst thing that we could possibly do right now is expand the money supply. It would be, does it, well, I mean, do you need any more proof than the last 3 years? They printed money and gave it away, and yeah, and look what happened. And we had 9% inflation. Does anyone want to go through that again? I don't think so.
If they did that, and if I were in the Federal Reserve, I would resign immediately and say, I cannot put up with the stupidity. You're charging us with bringing inflation down, and then you're throwing $1 trillion at us for free based on nothing?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Terrible idea.
So the bottom line here is just stop worrying about the whole debt ceiling thing. It is absolutely not worth losing any sleep over. And the second they give in to each other just a little bit and they both declare victory, this is what I miss about people like Bill Clinton. When Clinton had to negotiate something and it came to shove, he would just do it. He'd go to a microphone, the closest one available, and say, I just won. I helped you, and I won. And what does a good politician do? They make a deal, and then they take credit, right?
Of course.
It's axiomatic. That is what will happen, essentially, on both sides this time. So the market will love it. I would not use that June 1 deadline as an excuse to get out of the market. I think that would be a very, very bad mistake. Just my opinion.
Yeah, it's tough right now because you have to decide between, we're headed into a recession. Let's just say we all agree on that. So what does that mean? Does that mean the market will go down? I mean, earnings season has been pretty strong.
Oh, those
jobs
numbers
are still available. The housing market is pretty strong, especially in Florida. Yep. There's a lot of decent news out there conflicting with this imminent recession. So what is the market going to climb a wall of worry, or is it going to crash again? It is a very confusing time in the market.
Well, and then look what happened yesterday too. The second Friday in a row maybe even longer than that, the streak, but where they bought into the close.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, market was down 400 yesterday.
It
something
was down
like that,
pretty big, Dow. Yeah, at least 3-something.
And it closed down 8?
Yeah.
I mean, if we'd had another 10 minutes.
It might have been positive, yeah.
Yeah. Something out there is telling people what I just told you, that walking away from this would be foolish. You're going to miss an opportunity.
I tend to agree. Now, that doesn't mean don't stay cautious. And the great thing about that right now is you can stay cautious and make a good return. You can get 5% on very relatively safe assets. And so put some of your portfolio in that, mm-hmm, and then don't pull out of the market entirely. But I don't see any reason to go all in either.
Who among you would not take, say, 30 to 60% of a fast rising equity market if you could, say, save on the downside 50, 40, 60%. So depending on your risk level and all that, having this available 4.85, I think you said now, on the big
just
money
on the
market,
money market
we use.
Yeah.
And treasuries you can get in the 5% range. And this is safe money, very safe money. it has made life for people like Adam and me so much easier.
For sure.
Because the last few times we were faced with an uncertainty of this nature, what we had available to keep your money safe was
0.1%.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And how do you tell somebody that you're going to put their money in something that is much lower than basically zero?
Yeah.
And that's before they pay any fees on it.
And the other nice thing about this, well, think about this. If last year, instead of going down 13%, what if the bond market had been up 5%?
Yeah.
It would have changed everything.
Everything.
Yeah. You would have seen a much different result on right. the 60-40 portfolio or anything like that, rather than everything moving in tandem and going down. It would have been a much better year.
Okay, we've got one more week in this earnings season. I'm going to give you some quick numbers. The beat rate for earnings is 66% compared to 59% on average, and the revenue beat rate is 69% compared to 56% so far. Typically, in the last week of the earnings reporting season, those numbers will come down a little bit because that's the kind of companies that are later in the game. But it's going to wind up being a smashing season.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's a good thing. All right, we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. This is the VanWee Financial Hour.
Once again, here's Stephen and Adam VanWee.
Welcome back to the VanWee Financial Hour. I'm Steve VanWee.
And I'm Adam VanWee.
We've been chuckling a little bit. The California people are at it again. It's just
unreal.
It's so remarkable. So Gavin Newsom thinks he wants to be the president of the United States.
Yeah. Hmm. And yeah, the headline that I read that prompted this was Gavin Newsom reveals California's budget deficit is $10 billion higher than he predicted as it soars to $32 billion, a $32 billion deficit. That's unreal. They have the highest tax rates in the country,
mm-hmm.
and they're $32 billion short, and people are leaving. 500,000 people exited California over the last 2 years.
He won't talk about that part of it.
No.
He'll talk about looming recessions or anything you want to talk about.
No, come to California. You're free to love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he starts a new year on July 1.
Unbelievable.
And how do they want to start it? With $800 billion in giveaways for reparations. And he let himself get into the position where that bill would go to his desk, and he has to take the heat for saying, there is no way in hell that we can do this.
No wonder he wants to run for president. He probably wants to resign before he has to veto it.
I got the biggest kick out of watching that TV this week where all the people who were pro-reparations were saying, no reparations, no vote. So if Black America won't vote for Gavin Newsom,
I think he'd still be pretty safe as the governor of California. But in a general, that would be a problem.
Not going anywhere. And I just have to laugh. He's such a, I hate to say the word idiot, except I can't think of anything else that fits better.
It's accurate, though.
It sure does. Let's see. Trivia question. How many months in a row did the producer price index rise faster than the consumer price index, the retail? So the wholesale prices are going up faster than retail can keep up with. And there is a point in that. All right. You all probably know that Adam and I are members of the Financial Planning Association. You're not an officer anymore, are you?
No.
Was.
I term limited out.
That's good, probably, because otherwise, if it were a regular body of work like that, you could probably get stuck in there for life.
Yeah.
So you don't have to be the one that looks bad, that just term limits.
No, there's a 5-year limit on being a board member. I was the president for 1 year, and so it was a good experience, so I definitely enjoyed it.
Well, among their other services, and I'm sure this is true in other industries as well, they have job posting boards. There's a word for it on the website where somebody can ask a question of the entire membership, and then anyone who wants to can respond. And I found an absolute dandy that I want to share with you. And this is from this morning, and it's about a fully funded life insurance product. Now, for those of you who don't know, we talk about them on and off, When you hear commercials like lifetime tax-free income, that sort of thing, and there are many, many websites and all kinds of salespeople out there doing these things, you liquidate everything you've got right now and you put it in this fully funded life insurance product and you just borrow your own money tax-free all the way to your death, and that's that. Isn't it fabulous? Well, there's some problems with these things, and we've talked about it. I've actually talked about it on and off for 21 years of radio now, and I'll never stop until they stop. Here's the FPA member writing in her question. Hello, I have a client who's 95 years old, female. Long story short, about 40 years ago, after receiving a large settlement, the advisor funded a life insurance policy with the majority of the proceeds from the settlement. The policy has a $2 million death benefit and an $88,000 annual premium. Well, you should be looking at a pot of dough there, huh?
Wow.
$88,000. The client is in moderately good health. Now, remember, I said she's 95, right? She drives, active in her community, and has a sharp memory, overall good health, no major health concerns. Unfortunately, she can't afford to continue making the $88,000 annual premium. She's forced to look at selling the policy. She has been given a $400,000 offer to buy the policy from a life settlement company. Do you think it's a good idea?
My gut says it's not terrible.
This gets better. First answer. First step, have your client request an in-force illustration from the insurance company to see what happens if she stops paying the premiums. More specifically, how long will the policy last before lapsing? If she's been paying at least the scheduled premium for 40 years, policy should have a fairly large cash value. Policy may last until her life expectancy without making any additional premiums. Next, check and see if there's a reduced paid-up option. This means your client can stop paying premiums completely in return for a reduced death penalty and pay no cash savings. You may also be able to convert the permanent policy to an extended term policy for a term period based on the accumulated. Now, depending on how much you know about life insurance, anytime you're paying into a life insurance policy like a variable universal life or universal life, and you get to a certain point, as long as you have a cash value, they will give you other options to do it. Rather than keep paying this thing, they might say, so you got $100,000 in your account. They might say, well, that'll fund for the rest of your life a $150,000 term policy. And sometimes that sounds really good because everybody gets tired of paying their annual premiums, and it doesn't have to be $88,000 to get tired of it. All right, the original says, I appreciate it. Thank you. It's a universal life. So long as premiums are paid, it does not expire. It's flexible and ongoing. We have run illustrations. All current value, cash value, has been exhausted. Oops. You know that pool of money?
Yeah.
It's now zero. Another answer comes in. Sorry to hear the policy performed so poorly considering there is no cash value and she isn't willing or able to continue keeping the policy in force. Selling it may be the best out. Or see how much it would cost to fully pay it up if she feels she wants or needs the policy to eventual death. I'm curious, do you know how much she's cumulatively paid into the policy? Hopefully it hasn't been $88,000 every year for the last 40 years. And the originator again says she paid $1.5 million for a $3 million death benefit, then reduced the death benefit to $2 million. It's a bad story of a widow taken advantage of and given bad advice. After all these years, she claims she didn't know what she had and was just merely relying on the advisor for advice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we've heard that before.
Yep. Another one pipes in here. Like so-and-so said, definitely get an in-force illustration. Without knowing how much cash value there is and how long it would support paying the cost of the insurance and policy, you know, on and on here, because he obviously posted that before reading the part about there is no cash value. So the originator says, again, unfortunately, there's no cash value left. Illustrations have been run. It's a UL, universal life, so it's ongoing as long as premiums are paid. Another one chimes in. This is really common for older UL policies, which were issued when rates were higher. For those of you who don't know, universal life was an invention of, I believe, Merrill Lynch Company back in the 70s. You might remember when we were all having a lot of fun with our money market accounts. They were paying 12, 13, 14. Of course, inflation was 17, 18, 19. But everybody liked the big number of dollars coming in, so they didn't complain about it. Well, these things were invented to match or compete with at least the money markets and the CDs that were available at the time at high rates, because otherwise the life insurance wasn't looking good on paper. So they made illustrations that made assumptions like these rates, these interest rates that we're going to pay you in the policy will last forever. You'll have so much money when you get older. You won't have to pay anything and it'll last forever, and on and on and on. Back to the response. What a shame. These kinds of policies absolutely must be reviewed annually, and it's a shame so many don't. Nothing wrong with UL unless it's not monitored. And then last person chimes in, you hit the nail on the head. If proper annual reviews were done, she would have picked up what the majority of her money was invested in life insurance. She would have questioned him, and a correction could have been made early in the process, and this all would have been prevented. Well, there's a lesson in here that we have been screaming about for a long, long time. These products depend on what the insurance industry calls an illustration. And an illustration is a hypothetical bunch of numbers that shows you if our investments return 8% or 9% or 10%, this is all the money you're going to have at a certain age. The problem is they don't return 8% or 9% or 10% because interest rates have never seen that level before, and it's very unlikely that they ever will. So what happens as these policies gain age is that every year your cash balance goes down, because guess what? You get a year older every year, and you are paying the first money that comes from that policy. You are paying the cost of the death benefit at your new age, and it goes up every year. I had an occasion to do one a few years ago with a fellow that was 90 years old, and he was paying $28,000 a year in his policy for the death benefit, and it was decreasing at a very rapid pace because it couldn't keep up. When these people start talking about lifetime tax-free income, I want you all to run away and call us, and we'll talk about it further. We'll be right back. This is the Ben Wee Financial Hour.
Once again, here's Stephen and Adam Van Wee.
Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
Lines are open, 904-222-8255. How many consecutive months has the producer price index risen faster than the consumer price index? And I'll let you know one thing. It is an all-time record. How about that?
It is. And we were just talking during the break about that last scenario mm-hmm. that you laid out, and we were calculating what she lost had she put it in a portfolio that yielded 6%, she would have returned over 40 years. That $1.5 million investment would have been about $10.5 million. And if she had made 8% on it, you'd be looking at about $36 million.
And then you figure over a long period of time, the S&P has actually returned about 10%.
Yep, I can do that as well. And that would have been $80 million.
Huh.
Yeah.
Now, I'm no fan of reading anything on the radio, but I thought to really illustrate that, it should be given exactly as it was posed from both sides of the argument. And it, you know, if you have people in your family that you know are doing these things, we'll take a look at any of that with absolutely no obligation. There's a lot of people out there that are going to be really disappointed as they got in these things. I evaluated the first one I'd ever seen. I evaluated for a friend who was an across the street neighbor. That was in the year 2000. And I took the illustration. This one was a proposal where they'd mortgage their house and put it into one of these fully funded life insurance things.
Oh, gosh.
And the numbers were astounding. Absolutely astounding. So I wasn't even a CFP at the time. I was studying to be one. And it took me a couple of days to go through it all because I had never seen one quite like it. And one day I was sitting there looking at it, and I had one of those I could have had a V8 moments when I realized that he was talking about an $800,000 mortgage. And the one thing that wasn't in the cash flow was repaying that mortgage or even paying the interest on it. When that went in there, the value went from millions to not. And we're so highly regulated in our business that if we ever did anything like that, everybody from the SEC to the CFP board would be on our doorstep putting padlocks on it.
Rightfully so. If I did that, I would hand over my license.
Yeah, absolutely. And the insurance industry has always been regulated by the states. And the states are very adamant that it stay that way. The problem is the states are horrible at regulating financial activity. And I'm including Florida in that, and Florida's probably better than most. In some ways, it's kind of similar to the Silicon Valley Bank deal, where the people, in this case it was the Federal Reserve, that were required to audit them and keep them in check were just not doing their job. The risks were building up unnoticed, and it cost everybody big time. So, I don't want to be scaring everybody about everything, but we get these proposals from people every now and again, and I shake my head and wonder. Oh, well. Anyway, how about some more fun? You know, there's something I'm going to be starting up today, I guess, and I'm going to be on it more. It doesn't really seem to me, and I think to most people, that it's a very complicated question whether to use a Roth or a traditional for your 401k or IRA. But it can be, and it should be.
It is. We have this discussion a lot.
Yes, we do.
I think part of it is caused by the fact that many more plans offer a Roth option now than mm-hmm. even 3 years ago. I think it's probably quadrupled or more in the number of times that we see this option presented.
Now, the ideal outcome, and we see this once in a while when we get a potential new client in and we look over everything, they've got a Roth situation and a traditional situation and hopefully some other, everybody's got an annuity, practically everybody, that's called Social Security. So when you're solving a problem, can I retire is the usual problem, or when can I retire? You've got to consider lifetime income and assets and all those things. But if you have a Roth, or if you're doing Roth conversions, which of course has been a very, very big part of our business over the last few years, especially as we're getting more and more years where the required minimums aren't needed to be taken, which leaves the door open for the Roth conversions. But there have always been some things that are overlooked, and it usually involves tax planning. The biggest selling point for Roth isn't necessarily true. And I've been going over this for the last couple of days and thinking about it because we've had a couple of those inquiries this week. Back in 1997, the Roth IRA was sanctioned because of Senator Roth. And my first thought was, and then the more I thought about it, good. And you should dig in deeper and see what's actually going on. It's all good. And all of the financial professionals at the time, I didn't get into this until 2001, so they were already pretty much settled in. But everybody had done these studies, and they were coming out with the same result. And mathematically, there's no other way you're going to come out. The assumption was your tax rate today will be exactly the same as your tax rate in retirement. Therefore, the traditional IRA and the Roth IRA are exactly the same. Well, what's wrong with that picture? First off, the assumption. So people got more and more enthused about the Roth because more and more people were telling them that your tax rates are going to be much higher in retirement than they are during your working life because, well, everybody knows taxes in the future are going to be higher. So I spent 12 years maybe of my radio career telling people that I have yet to see a proposal out there that has any credibility where tax rates go up. Everybody was saying for years and years and years, everybody who had any clout was saying that what we really needed to do was lower tax rates and have fewer and fewer deductions because you know what they're trying to do. They're trying to find a world where they tax your gross income, but they can't say that. But along came Donald Trump and the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 that took place on January 1, 2018. And guess what? Marginal tax rates were hacked down. Well, how does that fit into your Roth strategy? It doesn't seem to be playing real well. It might still. We have other people in the White House now who would love to raise your tax rates and have said so on many, many occasions. And that may or may not be the biggest concern you have either. But meanwhile, what is the opportunity cost? That's a term you'll hear from us a lot. What is the opportunity cost of doing a Roth? Well, first off, you can shrink the number of dollars that you have in your account, cash or otherwise, by doing a Roth because you have to tax that income first. So if you're putting money into a Roth, the same amount of money in the Roth or the traditional is not the same amount of money that you've got invested in the market over time. You'll have more money in the traditional to invest over time. There's a couple other things that go on, too. The nature of our tax code, I don't remember exactly when this started. Do you remember when the zero rate for capital gains and qualified dividends started? I think
was it the it tax might have been, cut and jobs act?
No, I think it had to be before that. Okay. I think that was just expanded.
Okay.
One of the things TCJA did was it made those brackets really wide. And this is something we deal with a lot. A married couple right now is in the bottom two brackets, which is the key for getting all this stuff
10%
free.
10% and 12%.
Yeah. Until a taxable income
well
of
into the
89.5.
I thought it was into the 90,000s actually, but it's somewhere in that range. Yeah.
It's right about in there, which means you could have a gross income of 110 or 20 because you get a standard deduction anyway, and any money you put into a traditional IRA reduces your top line income, which is excellent. That's the best deduction you can get. And any money you put into your 401k is an above the line income before taxable income, in other words. If you can reduce your taxable income by using a traditional and through your tax planning, you can see that if you did it as a Roth, you're going to bump up to the next version of the tax code, which is what, 22 or something like that now?
Yeah, the 22% starts at 89,000, as you said. But if you include the standard deduction in that, you can actually make between 110 and 120,000, depending on your status when filing. But that's pretty incredible to pay just 12%.
But if you're doing your deductions, we have a call in.
Yeah, there's a phone call.
Good morning. We only have a minute.
Hey, good morning.
Let's see what we can do, and I'll finish this next week.
Yeah, I know time is short, so I'll just give a very quick guess. 15.
Not quite close enough. It's 11 and counting.
Okay.
But I only had a plus or minus one.
By the way, the PPI does affect the CPI.
It does.
If producers increased, cost to the consumer, I assume, increases also.
Most of the time.
Most of the time.
That's great.
All right, have a great weekend. Thank you.
Appreciate it. I'm going to carry on this Roth conversation, and we'll go a little bit more into the effects of the PPI and CPI, I think, because we have things to talk about there. But thanks for listening again. And we plan to be here next week and for many weeks thereafter. So plan to be here with us. I say, have a good one. Happy Mother's Day, everybody. This is the Vanway Financial Hour.
AM 600 WBOP, Jacksonville.